May it please the Court. I think there are two key issues in the case. One is whether an attorney can represent a criminal defendant if he previously met with the victim about the about representing him in the same matter, listened to the victim describe at least some of the facts, took the victim's evidence into his law office for a while, and promised to work on the case and then gave him some advice about remedies. And the second question is, a big interesting question, I think, is what sanction is necessary in this case, almost regardless of how the court handles the conflicts case. What sanction is necessary given the four admonitions that have already responded and received, these two new violations, all involving neglect and some harm to the clients and some communication issues, none of which involve any purposeful horrible conduct. These are just neglect cases that have built up over time and failing to protect clients' interests. I'd like to address the latter question first. And the court, I think, has adopted a fairly, maybe very analytical approach to how to determine sanction in these cases. And it's been essentially a policy lately of graduated discipline. At least that's been our impression. And in fact, you know, one of the other things that the court's done is looked at these ABA sanction standards, and the sanction standards refer to prior offenses as being aggravating circumstances and a pattern of misconduct is something that should be considered. The other thing that courts have looked at and the standards look at as well is the nature of the violations. These are, again, you know, they involve neglect. They don't involve purposeful conduct, and they involve but some harm has resulted despite that. In this case, we do have as aggravating circumstances the four prior admonitions, all for communication diligence type violations, one involving a fee agreement problem. And we also have the aggravating circumstance of substantial experience, 37 years of practice, 33 of which involve no discipline. It's only been the last 4 years where there's been any problems at all. And the mitigating circumstance is the obvious one, that we're not alleging any dishonesty, and that should be considered a mitigating circumstance. We think that suspension is an appropriate disposition because we have to do something. The admonitions haven't succeeded in protecting the public. And I still think, and I told this to the panel as well, to the disciplinary hearing panel that heard the case, that probation can work in this case. We may not need a hard suspension. Probation may be it's the kind of thing that probation ought to be able to help with.
But you only recommend probation in the event that he acknowledges some remorseful or something.
Yeah, or acknowledgement. I mean, I think this conflict is enough that he should be able to acknowledge it before we go on. And that was the argument in the brief. That's right. That I think probation fits a lot better if he can say that I get it on that conflict.
And has he done so to this date?
No.
And your argument is that a reprimand would be an insufficient step up?
I don't think, right. I think a reprimand would not protect the public. I mean, we have too many. We have four cases in 4 years with admonitions that haven't done anything, that haven't changed the practice. And the one case, the first case, not involving the conflict, was just one that he says slipped through the cracks. And I know that happens all the time, but he's been warned numerous times to create systems so that doesn't happen. And then he didn't even remember the complainant in that case, his client in that case, coming to him afterward and said, "He let a default occurred against me, and I'm frustrated. Tell me what happened." And he said, "I don't remember even having that conversation with her." So something is awry.
That statement could have been disbelieved by the hearing panel?
Could have been disbelieved by the hearing panel. The panel did find a violation in that. I mean, they found a 1.4 communication violation. So I'm presuming that they accepted her explanation on that.
Rather than his, that she made.
They didn't say, "We believe her, we don't believe him," but they did find the violation.
Now, the respondent indicated that he might be ADD. Did he provide any professional opinions?
He said that his He said that his doctor had diagnosed it in 1994 or something like that. That's all. I mean, there's no record, there's no testimony, there's no exhibit from the doctor, there's nothing else. I'm sorry.
The record does indicate, at least from Mr. Miller, that he takes some medication for that, as I recall from that.
I think that's right. But the rule that the court adopted recently, 5.285, only allows the consideration as mitigation. Of course, it's not a defense at all, but only allows it this consideration of mitigation if there's independent mental health professional who provides evidence of the disorder and the causation.
Well, that wasn't in effect at the time, at this time, though, was it?
Well, I think it was certainly in effect at the time of the hearing, and I would suggest that it's a procedural rule that could be applied to the conduct. So the other interesting question, which may be an academic question, is whether there was a conflict with Mr. Gieskin, his first client. There's a conflict under 1.7A1 if the representation is directly adverse. Here we have a victim of a crime and the defendant of a crime. The cases from around the country use language such as it's a per se violation or it's inescapably adverse for a criminal defendant and a victim to be, their interests are inescapably adverse and diametrically opposed interests are the language they use. And in this case, what we have, of course, is where the victim never got another chance to say, well, here's what I really care about. But instead, the respondent decided that it's in everybody's best interest for me to know that restitution is desirable. The victim said he wanted restitution. I'll grant him that. But he never went back to him and said, is there more? Or is this what you really want? Because he decided he didn't represent him more. But he did still claim that he knew what was in everybody's best interest and that somehow that made it okay to decide whether that there was no adverse interest because he was protecting everybody. I don't think lawyers get to make that call. I mean, I think that's the deal about client communication. We have to listen to our clients and find out what they want, and we don't just do it the first day they come in the office. We do it before we settle a case. We do it before we cross-examine witnesses that are opposing that's cross-examine themselves, their own client, their own prospective client, whichever it was. So I don't think he just can't make that kind of call on his own without it being some sort of a conflict. And the client, the initial client, the victim of the bad check, also wanted the defendant to go to jail. How could that be anything other than adverse interest? I mean, it's hard to imagine. He did go to jail for a little while. But again, the lawyer never went back to the client and said, to the initial client, and said, is this enough jail? I mean, sometimes victims' lawyers come to prosecutors. Prosecutors still have to act in the best interest of the state, but victims' lawyers say things such as, I don't want him to go to jail. I want him to be out so he can work and pay me back. Or I do want him to go to jail. I want him to go to jail forever. And then victims' lawyers have interests other than just saying, just a general feel that this lawyer, putting himself in the position of a judge or an arbiter, said, well, I'm just going to work it out for everybody, and it'll be fine. So, again, I ask the court to impose a suspension in the case. I think it's a fair disposition. I think probation can work. And frankly, I think it can even help with the ADD. I mean, the attention deficit disorder, we can certainly consider it at this point once we get some evidence of it, and we can help with that. Thank you.
I'm Gerald Drake for Spencer Miller. May it please the court. I'm going to be brief, but I want to point out a timeline that I put together when I read this transcript. The check was dated October 20th, 2007. A few months later, March or April of 2008, this Mr. Gieskin brought the check into Miller's office. And he wants to send the guy who wrote the check, Robert Stevenson, to jail. And he says that. Mr. Miller says, I'm a lawyer. I'm a civil lawyer. I can't do that. I'm going to send you to the prosecutor. Now, this is March and April of 2008. Then Mr. Miller is engaged by Mr. Stevenson on a gun prosecution. He had a sawed-off possession of a sawed-off shotgun. This was later in July of 2008, 3 or 4 months later. As part of the deal, the prosecutor tosses in the check prosecution, which is 2 months later, 9/24, September 24th, 2008. Then there's a plea bargain. And 6 months later, this complaint is filed against Mr. Miller, alleging that, wait a minute, you represented me and then you represented Mr. Stevenson. Now, the point is, when the deal on the check and the gun was made, if Mr. Miller, this is why he doesn't accept responsibility, if at that point he simply sent him to the prosecutor and he didn't know that that this man thought that he was his lawyer, how is he going to know to withdraw from the
Isn't it well known if you have a divorce, a dissolution client come into your office and sit down and talk to you about it, and then they walk out and they don't actually hire you? I mean, wouldn't you know that you have a problem having received the communications after consulting with them on the other side?
If you have received communication from one party in a divorce, you're out of the case completely as far as the other side goes.
And why doesn't that concept apply to this? When he sits down and has a conversation with the victim about the criminal case, he ought to have known without question he can't be involved on the other side representing the criminal defendant.
Well, if he had sat down and had a conversation with him, that would certainly apply. But really, if you look at the transcript as to what Mr. Miller says, page 50, it's A15, appendix 15, page 50, lines 14 to 24, he was angry and he wanted him put in jail. And I said, well, I cannot put him in jail. I'm going to tell you right now, if you want to do something about this, you need to go to the prosecuting attorney. He can put him in jail, and it commonly happens in that county that people do go to jail.
But I'm looking at the evidence from Mr. Gieskin that says he told respondent he wanted him jailed. Respondent told Mr. Gieskin he would work on his case.
That's Mr. Gieskin's testimony.
But if we find those facts, would that be sufficient to?
It sure would. Okay. If you find the facts that Mr. Gieskin says, I've hired Mr. Miller, and he's working on my case, that's clearly
so
a possible.
So the disciplinary hearing panel did believe Mr. Askin.
The hearing panel did believe Mr. Gieskin.
And I'm focusing on this because, as I understand from Mr. Phillips, if your client doesn't recognize a conflict in that situation, that's a great ongoing concern to the court. But your client recognizes if those facts, as alleged by Mr. Gieskin, are true, then that would be a conflict, but he doesn't think those were the facts.
He says that's not what happened.
Okay.
He says, I wasn't, but I don't know a lawyer alive that wouldn't acknowledge that that's a conflict. I'm sure, of course, he recognizes a conflict. But what I'm pointing out is that at the time, all he had done is send him to the prosecutor, and Mr. Stevenson comes to him on the gun prosecution, and they throw in a check. There's no conflict if he hadn't sat down and talked and got the information, as you say, or hadn't agreed to work on the case. Now, I realize it's a credibility issue.
As a practical matter, what, if any, confidential information does Mr. Gieskin claim that he gave to Mr. Miller that would create a conflict?
I found none in the record, Your Honor. I don't know what... But confidential.
But their interests are in conflict. I mean, one's the victim and one's,
yeah. By definition, their interests are in conflict. Okay. Now, the way it worked out, it was probably to Mr. Gieskin's benefit, but that doesn't excuse the fact that that the interests are in conflict. And when I say it was his benefit, part of the deal was he had to get restitution. Mr. Stevenson went to jail. And if he wants to sue him in a tort case, why, you've got a guilty plea, which is an admission.
If this court were to find that it accepted the disciplinary hearing panel's determinations of fact, does that require us then to accept the discipline suggested by the chief disciplinary counsel, or do you have an argument that a reprimand would still be appropriate? Because whatever they found was, in fact, this was not what Mr. Miller understood, or some other argument. What's your argument on discipline? And does it depend on if we accept the DHP's findings?
Well, my argument on discipline is that a reprimand is appropriate. I mean, as far as the mistakes that he's made, which he has admitted to prior, there's no excuse for those. And there's certainly no excuse for not showing up for somebody if they've hired you to do it. But in the Gieskin matter, there certainly was no intent to harm and no knowledge on his part at the time he made the deal on the check prosecution. I think in his brief he's noted that the story of Mr. Gieskin sort of increased as it went along. That's something I won't go into that, but. Mr. Gieskin, for example, said, yeah, I went back and talked to him about it. And he said, I'm working on it. I think he said he testified he did that twice. That is denied by Mr. Miller, and that was not included in the complaint. As we go through this case, why, we seem to be developing more facts that tend to help Mr. Gieskin. All Mr. Miller can do is simply deny him. He's pointed out that there was no retainer and no contract. And where's the file? If you're representing somebody, you've surely got a file on them. In re or Gieskin versus Stevenson. There was none subpoenaed or none put into evidence, and the conversation itself that I repeated by Mr. Miller is actually pretty much corroborated by Mr. Gieskin on appendix number 6, page 16, line 24 and 20-25. So I went to see Mr. Miller to see if I could prosecute him and maybe get him thrown in jail for not paying it. Now, that's basically the same thing that Mr. Miller testified to.
Mr. Drake, it appears that your client, Mr. Miller, has had a stellar career practicing law for 33-plus years, and it's just been in these last 4 years that he's had so many violations. And if we only issue a reprimand, how can we be assured that we're fulfilling our duty, and that is to protect the public from future ethical violations? You know, how can we be assured that he will, that maybe he needs to learn, or maybe that he will learn better law office practice management? How can we be assured that this will never occur again? Or couldn't he benefit from some help if he was on a probationary situation?
I think perhaps. I think the answer is probably yes, yes to that. Sequential.
But we don't have probation with reprimands, though. We don't.
It'd have to be a suspension with.
Yeah. Well, but still, the answer is perhaps. Perhaps he could. That's a judgment call that I don't know that I'm really willing to make.
You're saying your client's not opposed to taking classes in law practice management and things of that sort.
We all would be willing to take courses in law practice management. I've been practicing for 45 years, and I could benefit from classes in law practice management. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Phillips, I've got a couple of questions for you concerning the facts of this case.
Yes.
If this court didn't think there was sufficient evidence to believe that a attorney-client relationship existed between Mr. Miller and Mr. Gieskin, then the next issue would be whether or not there was any confidential information received in that initial contact, because either then would prohibit him later from representing Mr. Stevenson, correct?
I think so.
And that's kind of under the divorce scenario. If you're willing to go ahead and go into confidential information, and then no attorney-client relationship comes about, then that was just a bad decision on your part to talk to him that far.
Right.
But
the panel said it was a conflict that could be waived, so they must have thought there wasn't confidential information, because they said the problem was failing to reveal and get a waiver.
Well, they could have felt that there was an attorney-client relationship.
But
if they did, then it would have to be waived.
I'm sorry. I do think they did find that there was a violation, and I mean that there was an attorney-client relationship, because they found the 1.7a.
Right. But then they said it could be the problem was not revealing the fact to the second client that he represented the first and vice versa, and that he should have gotten consent, which you couldn't do if there was an actual conflict. So I'm wondering if they...
Right. I mean, certainly the other cases suggest that when they're that diametrically opposed, even a waiver might not suffice.
So does that help us on what they found about whether there was confidential information actually imparted that perhaps they didn't find it? Otherwise, they would have not said you could waive it, would they?
I wish I could remember exactly their wording. I didn't draft it for them. It wasn't a suggested findings or anything.
If the court were to believe what Judge Fisher said, would that change the recommendation to a reprimand, or would OCDC still recommend a state suspension?
Yes, we would still recommend a state suspension. I think the Backman case, the non-conflict case alone, along with four admonitions in the last 4 years, is enough that we have to try something else other than saying don't do this anymore. I mean, I know the court's words mean more than words from our office, but still, it'd be doing the same thing than what we've done in the past. So I think we have to try something else.
Well, there's a difference between a reprimand and an admonition.
Yeah, it comes from the court. Is the huge difference?
Exactly.
I understand that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that.
There's no
effort at rehabilitation that would be guaranteed in the process. And if the court does want to issue probation, we'd ask for an opportunity to suggest some conditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is taken under submission. Court is